2007. We have a very short meeting this morning because we're due on the floor at 8:30. But I think we have time to consider a couple of bills. We're going to take Senate Bill 301 first and then Senate Bill 65, and probably will not get to 233, 267, or 271 today. With apologies to anybody who came for those, we are in a situation where the advance notice of the hearings has to be given out 72 hours, and we don't know what the floor schedule is going to be, so we're not able to plan accordingly. I will now open a public hearing on Senate Bill 301. Council Kamenson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. ORS 86.750 requires a trustee to serve an occupant personally with a notice of a nonjudicial foreclosure of a trust deed, an intent to sell the property. SB 301A would change this requirement for service of the notice on the property occupant. What SB 301A would do is require the trustee to, one, attempt to personally serve the occupant three times, with each attempt occurring at least 2 days after the attempt before it; two, to post a copy of the notice in a conspicuous place on the property each time personal service fails; and three, to mail the notice to the occupant after the third failed attempt.
Thank you, Council. We have David Fennell from the Oregon State Bar Debtor Creditor Section. Mr. Fennell.
Chairman Pearson, members of the committee, I'll try to be mercifully brief. As suggested, my name is David Fennell. I'm with the Oregon Bar Association's Debtor Creditor Committee and its subcommittee for legislative affairs. And I'm here today basically just to ask that you consider passing this bill out of your committee and onto the floor. It's intended essentially to bring more certainty to the foreclosure process presently, with the requirement that an occupant, not all occupants, but one occupant be personally served the notice. It tends to sometimes bog down the process when somebody denies that he's been served or somebody starts evading service. Sometimes foreclosures can go on for a year, 2 years, while that one occupant is attempted to be served. The purpose of this bill is really to remedy those situations and to allow a trustee to alternatively serve the occupant by posting the property, in this case, three times. The nonjudicial foreclosure statutes in surrounding states, Washington, California, for instance, require only a posting of the notice on the property once and no attempts at personal service. Idaho has a statute that's very similar to this statute that requires three attempts to serve each time posting. And if the third time isn't the charm, then the third time is the charm by posting. It reduces the problem of service ambiguity that often comes up in Oregon foreclosure cases, and it vexes title companies, it vexes lenders who are trying to realize on their security, and it doesn't necessarily protect borrowers, because oftentimes the borrowers are not the occupants. It could be, in a lot of cases that we see, it turns out to be tenants who may be involved in nefarious activities, who don't want to be served, who don't want to get out, who don't want to be found. They might have pit bulls in the front yard, they might have gates, and this sort of solves the problem of dangerous confrontation, urban blight in foreclosure situations. And it seems to be a good win for all considered. Our group is a balanced representation of debtor and creditor attorneys, and there's no opposition in our group to this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Fennell. Any questions?
I have
thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Fennell, this whole year I've never heard us say we're modeling our laws after Idaho. That's interesting.
Believe me, Representative Wisden, when I first suggested this, I was almost pleading and begging for the California approach.
I'm saluting you. I think that's good. Obviously, I'm concerned about, on your second page, the number three, cause of service delay. I understand the first two. Now, I'm assuming, which is a mistake, I guess, but that you know, you do make good attempts. I live in an area where people are away from their home 6 months. They have a home that's vacant for 6 months. Can you tell us or assure us that those people are not going to be unjustly served?
You bet. Mr. Chair, Representative Wisnett, the statute requires personal service upon an occupant, but it also requires mailing at the last known mailing address of the of any person who's interested in the property. And borrowers with second homes typically will have as their primary address their mailing address with the lender, and that's what's communicated to the trustee.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead.
So, really, this is helping you with those that are trying to avoid this, the tenant of this bill from Idaho that we're looking at.
Representative Wilson, yes, that would be probably the biggest single reason for this is those who are avoiding service, those who are tough to find in terms of just doing the formality of a personal service, and just trying sometimes to understand when a house is occupied and when it isn't is very difficult when you can't go in, the curtains are down. You know, you use anecdotal stories from neighbors who say, well, we see them once in a while, but, you know, we haven't seen anybody there in 12 months. Is it abandoned? Is it occupied? We don't know. And that makes it really tough.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Further questions? Mr. Fennell, I need a little more of a sort of a primer on foreclosure on trustees. What is the current law in Oregon? How would I go about if I were pursuing a non-judicial foreclosure on a trustee because I hadn't been being paid on the obligation? How is the lender? How would I go about that?
Chairman McPherson, the main approach would be if you were the lender, you would appoint a qualified trustee in Oregon to start a foreclosure. And when I say qualified trustee, I mean a lawyer who's licensed in Oregon, a licensed title company in Oregon, a bank. You probably wouldn't employ an arm of the U.S. government, but they're also qualified. They would start the foreclosure with a notice of default and election to sell. And that gets recorded in the county in which the property is located. It gets mailed, or a notice of sale gets mailed to everyone with an interest in the property that shows up on a title report. So that would include junior lien holders and borrowers, and anybody with, you know, a wild hair interest in the property gets a mailing by certified return receipt requested and by first class mail. So two mailings each.
And I assume that includes the borrower who has defaulted.
Absolutely.
Right.
Absolutely. They're number one.
But that's a certified mail. So there's no personal service at that point to the borrower this proceeding is beginning.
That's absolutely correct. It's ironic that the statute requires personal service upon an occupant who may or may not be the borrower, but does not require personal service upon the person who has the greatest interest in the property, its owner.
Right, right. I mean, it does seem odd that, I mean, because who knows who the occupant is? I mean, it seems to be based on a premise that the owner is the occupant, is the borrower who has defaulted on the obligation, is in occupancy at the house, and that may well be often the case, but many in circumstances it wouldn't be.
Chairman McPherson, that's exactly right. That's you know, this statute was initially adopted, I believe, in the 70s. It's had some tweaking. There was a major tweaking in 1988. It's been so long, I can't remember. But for the most part, there hasn't been a lot of alteration to it. And so I think, you know, some of the realities have changed. Some of the sensibilities have changed. And I think at the time, probably, there were more residential occupants who were borrowers than today, where you see a lot of speculation, a lot of rental properties, a lot of tenants. And tenants do, by the way, get notice twice in the foreclosure process. They get notice, 120 days notice is what the mailed notice is to all parties. But they also get a notice toward the end advising them that a foreclosure sale is about to happen and they're going to have to get out if somebody buys at the foreclosure sale. So they're actually a special class, too, heightened above the occupants themselves. Excuse me, above the borrowers themselves.
So this bill doesn't change the requirement that service be made on an occupant, it clarifies the way in which that service can be accomplished.
Chairman Pearson, that's exactly right. I lobbied hard in our group to adopt the post one time, and they just weren't quite ready for it, and so I suggested Idaho as a compromise.
I see. Okay, any further questions? Okay, then I will close the a public hearing on Senate Bill 301 and open a work session on Senate Bill 301. Mr. Chair, Representative Wisnik.
I move pass Senate Bill 301A to the House of the due pass recommendation.
Representative Wisnik moves that we pass Senate Bill 301A to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Any discussion? If not, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative
Aye.
Representative Cameron.
Aye.
Representative Flores.
Aye.
Representative Krieger.
Aye.
Representative Reed.
Aye.
Vice Chair Barker.
Aye.
Vice Chair Wisnik.
Aye.
Chair Wisnik.
Aye. Senate Bill 301A moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation. And Representative Wisnik, would you care?
Sure.
Great. I will close the work session of Senate Bill 301 and go back to the top of our agenda and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 65. Council comments.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. ORS 180.060 provides that the Attorney General may not represent or give legal advice to anyone other than the state officers, agency boards, or commissioners. This prohibition impacts whether the Oregon Public Employees Retirement Fund may serve as a, quote, lead plaintiff in a securities fraud class action. Generally, a lead plaintiff in a securities class action is a sophisticated party whose interests are similar to those of other class members and is appointed by the court to make strategic decisions in the case. What SB 65 would do is permit the Attorney General to represent the state or any agency or officer of the state as a lead plaintiff in a securities fraud class action.
Thank you, counsel. And we have both Fred Boss and Kate Richardson signed up. Why don't you come up together? In whichever order makes sense.
Very well. Good morning, Chairman McPherson, members of the committee. I'm Kate Richardson, Chief of Staff of State Treasurer Randall Edwards, and I submitted a letter from the Treasurer for you. My testimony is substantively the same. This bill is a narrow change to Chapter 180. Questions arisen that Council has articulated for you whether the Public Employees Retirement Fund could serve as a lead plaintiff, and under current interpretation that is not the case because the Attorney General would be prevented from representing any other parties in that situation. So this amendment would clarify the statute and resolve this issue. As you may be aware, the fund regularly participates in federal securities class action suits when it suffered losses due to fraud or other security violations. For those class actions, the court appoints a lead plaintiff to represent the members of the class. To date, Oregon's been unable to serve as be the lead plaintiff in any of the class actions in which it's been a member of the class. Pension funds from numerous other states, including California, New York, Wisconsin, Utah, Minnesota, Florida, have served as lead plaintiffs in securities fraud class actions, and the state treasurer believes that Oregon should have the ability to join these states in taking the lead to enforce the securities laws and to keep our national securities markets free from fraud. Oregon's fund is one of the largest public and institutional investors in the nation. We're in the upper $60 billion in size. And in some cases, this fund may be the best suited to perform the role of lead plaintiff to maximize recovery for the class. If Oregon could serve as a potential lead class plaintiff, it'll join other states in leading this effort to recover pension funds, school funds, and other state funds that have been lost to fraud. This will benefit the Oregon Public Employees Retirement Fund, as well as Oregon consumers, retirees, and taxpayers. The state could be in a better position to negotiate and monitor attorney's fees, to oversee settlement discussions and case strategy, and to negotiate other remedies that would benefit the market, such as corporate governance changes. Although Oregon currently has the ability to opt out of these class actions and seek separate recourse, Oregon should have the flexibility to act as lead plaintiff in a particular case if the circumstance if the circumstances warrant and the court appoints, and joins with other states that are prominent leaders in enforcing the securities laws.
Thank you, Ms. Richardson. Mr. Boss, why don't we hear from you, and then we'll open for questions.
Thank you, Chair McPherson, members of the committee. My name is Fred Boss. I am Chief Counsel of the Civil Enforcement Division of the Oregon Department of Justice. I'm testifying in support of Senate Bill 65. The Department of Justice is of the opinion it cannot represent a state fund as a lead plaintiff in a class action lawsuit. My written testimony provides the details of our analysis. Senate Bill 65 provides for a narrow change to Chapter 180 that would allow the Department of Justice to represent a state fund in a class action lawsuit involving a securities loss. Class action lawsuits are often used to obtain recoveries for funds which have lost monies due to securities fraud. I do not anticipate this tool to be used frequently, but it would be useful to ensure an adequate recovery for a state fund or to ensure that corporate governance changes are made for a corporation. I'd be pleased to answer any questions the committee may have.
Any questions, committee?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Kahn.
This is a question for counsel, and I'm being a little sarcastic here, but in your summary, you asked that a class action is carried through by a sophisticated party?
Well, a lead plaintiff. The lead plaintiff is supposed to be there's an analysis that a court goes through before they decide who can be the lead plaintiff. They look at the adequacy of counsel and your ability to represent other parties. So typically it'll be a fund or something like that. It doesn't have to be, but...
But does this mean that our attorney general is sophisticated?
In this sense, yes.
Thank you.
I was sure it meant a white tile.
That's
any figure.
Depending on what's recovered or what type of an award is made, where does that go? Is it depend with what the action was to protect PERS or whatever?
Mr. Chair, Representative Krieger, when there are recoveries in class actions, the amounts recovered go back to the those who lost the funds in the first place. So, and we do participate in currently in class action lawsuits, so the recoveries do go back to the fund.
Well,
go ahead.
Now, the costs that are incurred in doing that, where does that come from?
Go ahead and answer that one.
Chair McPherson, Representative Krieger, the costs are paid out of the recovery.
Oh, and what's the amount of percentage that the AG's office would get for an award?
Chair McPherson, Representative Krieger, I don't think we don't get anything.
Uh-uh. Okay, who gets it then? In other words, you're getting paid to do something to get the recovery, and who determines what your costs are?
Jimmy Pearson, Representative Krieger, about 99.99% of class action lawsuits are settled. Those settlements must be approved by the court. And almost all of them are in federal court, or the vast majority are in federal court. The settlement is worked out among the parties and is presented to the court, who must determine the fairness for the parties. And the court also determines whatever costs are going to be reimbursed and whatever compensation is due for the attorneys. The attorney's compensation is paid out of the recovery, and it's usually a percentage of the recovery as determined by the court, say usually around 10% or so. The Attorney General's office, our office has never handled a class action lead plaintiff lawsuit because we are unable to do so. The department opts out, or when we have on occasion opted out of lawsuits and proceeded forward in a separate action, with the fund being prosecuting its own cause of action, and the department has hired outside counsel as a special assistant attorney general to prosecute that action. We do not currently have in-house expertise in securities class action or securities litigation.
Just to follow up,
go ahead.
If you don't have expertise in, is there something in the budget that this passes, you're able to accommodate a position or two within the existing co-chair budget?
Representative McPherson, Representative Krieger, we don't currently plan on hiring extra FTE if this does pass. We do believe it would be used rarely, and I believe in at least for the next biennium, we would more likely than not hire outside counsel to prosecute the actions should the treasurer choose to join in a class action.
Okay.
Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Boss, could you give us a real-life experience or case where this would, you know, for a layman, how is this going to work? When is some guy that's investing the money from PERS, you know, putting in his pocket, or how? Give us an example of what we're talking about here, please.
Chair McPherson, Representative Wisnett. A good example, I believe, would be the Enron case.
I've never heard of that.
I knew that ever.
The OPERS or the fund PERF lost approximately $82 million due to the Enron collapse. Enron itself filed bankruptcy, and we do have claims in the bankruptcy that we're still prosecuting at this moment. There is, however, a class action lawsuit against the other entities involved, the Arthur Andersen, the banks, all sorts of other folks that might have been aided and abetted Enron in its collapse. That in that case, the if this statute had been in place, the we would have submitted our application to the court to become a lead plaintiff. The California PERS actually did, or is the lead plaintiff in the class action where various state entities are going after the aiders and abettors of Enron. We would have been in there either leading that and or co-leading that litigation.
Go ahead. So as a lead, we get our money first, we're going to get more money, we're not going to have to pay California law attorney general's office, is that?
Jimmy McPherson, Representative Wisden, what it does is it allows you to control the litigation. So you control the amount of money that the lawyers will get. Sometimes there is some criticism in class action lawsuits that the attorneys get too large of a percentage of the recovery. We could narrow it down so that the attorneys get less of a recovery. We could make sure that there are certain corporate governance issues that are taken care of. So if we were going after a corporation, we could make sure, we could say, as part of this settlement, we want you to have X amount of your members to be independent board members. So there are issues that we can address where we have control. If we're back in the pack as a class member, we have no control.
Mr. Chair.
Go ahead.
But it's got to be risk if you get to be lead to it, I'm assuming, right?
Chair McPherson, Representative Wisnett, yes. There, you have exposure to, if there is a loss, exposure to the costs. You have potentially exposure if it is unwarranted, attorney's fees for the other side. So there are certain risks. And you certainly have the risk of gathering, marshaling the testimony, that kind of thing.
Any further questions?
Mr. Chair, if I would add, the fund does participate in a number of class actions. Unfortunately, this is just part of the securities world out there. Because we have become such a major fund out there, that often we may be the heaviest hitter in a particular class. And we see, and although all the members of the class participate equally in the recovery, we may be in the best position because of our heavy hitter nature to negotiate lower attorney's fees or a higher recovery.
Ms. Richardson, it might be helpful for the committee to know the sort of the current sort of what's the, roughly the size of the PERV.
Well, actually, we've had some good markets lately. We're up in the, I think, $68 billion.
$68 billion, and in national terms, that in terms of the public retirement systems. I think we're one of the top several, right?
Absolutely. We're in the top 10 and in performance as well. So not only in size, but in performance. So for being kind of a mid-sized, smaller state, our fund actually is one of the top funds out there.
It's something that many Oregonians really aren't aware, is that we're a real strong player nationally in the investment markets because of that concentration we have, the success of the program. Any further questions? If not, I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 65 and open a work session on Senate Bill 65.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Bonici.
I just wanted to comment that when I practiced law, I worked for a firm that did securities class actions, and the benefits of being a lead plaintiff far outweigh any risk. Because it's primarily you are involved in a lot of the strategic decisions, and it's a good thing.
The metaphor I would use is the difference between being in the locomotive that's going down the track or being back in one of the cars watching where it's going.
So I move Senate Bill 65 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Bonamici moves Senate Bill 65 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion?
Does this help our Greg Brown bill?
I don't doubt if it does help that.
I'll
withdraw
that question.
Any further discussion? If not, the clerk call the roll.
Representative Bonamici.
Aye.
Representative
Cameron.
Aye.
Representative Moore.
Aye.
Representative Trigger.
Aye.
Representative Reed?
Aye.
Vice Chair Barker?
Aye.
Vice Chair Lehman?
Aye.
Chair McPherson?
Aye. Senate Bill 65 moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation. And Representative Bonamici, would you carry that bill?
Yes, I will. Thank you.
Okay, very good. We'll close the work session on Senate Bill 65. That's as much as we can get done today. The other bills on our agenda, Senate Bills 233, 267A, and 271A, will be rolled over to our next meeting tomorrow. And with apologies to people who came for those, but we didn't realize we were going to have only half an hour this morning, so we'll get to it tomorrow. That concludes as much of our agenda as we can complete.
We start early tomorrow.
No,
representative.
Don't start at 8. We're adjourned.